Welcome to the fifth debate hosted by the SO Forum. I'm Gene Epstein, economics and book review editor of Barron's Financial Weekly and the director of the SO Forum. Tonight's resolution reads as follows. Based on his record of accomplishments, Barack Obama has been a great president. Speaking for the affirmative will be Jonathan Chait, and speaking for the negative will be Matt Welch. Jonathan is a regular political columnist for New York Magazine and the author of the just published book, Audacity, How Barack Obama Defied His Critics and Created a Legacy That Will Prevail. He will be doing book signing and selling over there in the corner. Books are for sale now, but you'll get a chance to talk to Jonathan afterwards when those books are sold. Taking the negative will be Matt Welch, a Reason Magazine editor at large and featured player on the regular podcast, The Fifth Column. Our debaters have decided they're going to do something slightly offbeat. They will each get 10 minutes to do their pro and do their con. And then there will be 20 minutes of informal discussion between them before we go to the 30 minutes of question from the audience. Jonathan, you have 10 minutes to establish for the affirmative the case for the proposition. Take it away, Jonathan. Thank you.
Mike. If you're expecting a formal debater, you're going to be disappointed. I don't really have any experience in that, but I do argue with people, and I've argued with plenty of libertarians going back to college, of course. And a thing I found about arguing with libertarians is about politics is that it's a little bit like making a group decision about where you're going to go to dinner, and someone there is kosher. That person is not going to agree with you that you should go to a barbecue place. No matter how good you say the barbecue place is, they're not going to like the ribs. And I think that's a little bit of an analogous situation. You've got a value system, which I don't agree with, but I think I understand and I try to respect, that believes government should have a certain circumscribed role. So I'm not going to tell you that you're going to like what Barack Obama did, because he doesn't hold to that ideology. Those aren't his rules for what government should be. And he had completely different ideological starting point for what he tried to do. What I want to argue to you instead is that by Barack Obama's standards, by his own values, what he did was successful. He attempted a lot of change, and for the most part, that change worked by Obama's own standards. And I'm not going to go through anything like the whole book, but I'll try to run through what I think are the main examples of where Obama really did things that accomplished their stated purposes. The economic recovery. The United States was plunging into the worst crisis, as everyone knows, in 75 years when he took office. And he took a series of measures to stop it. The stimulus, of course, is believed by pretty much the entire economic field to have substantially mollified the scale of unemployment. The University of Chicago did an economist survey in 2014 of what was the unemployment rate in 2010. Was it lower or higher? And weighted by confidence level, 97% of the economists said that unemployment was lower as a result of the stimulus. A survey of macroeconomists found a complete consensus. Macroeconomists, people who basically are paid to do this for a living on behalf of business firms. There's basically no one in the macroeconomics field who doesn't think the stimulus did a lot to increase GDP. The range of the responses was from 2% to 3.4% of additional growth in 2010 alone, which is just an absolutely enormous amount. The stress test, mostly forgotten. If you go back to early 2009, the banks were failing. Investors were terrified of risk, and the TED spreads were skyrocketing because people did not know what was going to happen to the banks. And the stress test actually worked. It was sort of mocked on Saturday Night Live, became a punchline. They subjected every bank to a test of the assets, whether it had enough liquidity. And after they were done with it, those spreads basically went down to normal like levels, and the crisis in the banks was completely solved. The auto bailout, another thing, a method that libertarians object to, but I don't think you can possibly object to the results. the best accounting shows that they saved hundreds of billions of dollars in value. The Midwest basically was going to be completely sunk when the auto firms and the chains of suppliers that led the auto firms went down, leading to the kind of ripple effect that would have brought down my home state, Michigan, northern Ohio, Indiana, parts of Illinois. And the other thing to remember is that these firms ran their own welfare states. They ran their own pension programs, which were backed by the government. They ran their own healthcare systems. So if those auto companies went down and their suppliers went down, you'd have a lot of people whose pensions the government would have been on the hook to supply, whose healthcare, suddenly they would be getting healthcare then through the Affordable Care Act, not through the healthcare that they negotiated. And the payouts by the government would have been 10 times higher than what they spent to save those firms. So you can object to the method, but the auto bailout worked by its own terms. The Affordable Care Act. So for decades, the United States has developed the cruelest and most inefficient healthcare system in the world. The United States spends vastly more on healthcare than the next highest country, and is also the only industrialized country that doesn't have basic health insurance available to all its citizens. So we're spending a ton, and yet we had people who are suffering, people who are dying for lack of access to medical care, which really shouldn't happen in an industrialized country. And they attacked both those problems with enormous amounts of progress and enormous amounts of success. I think people are most familiar with the change in the uninsured. 20 million people gained health care who didn't have it previously. And all kinds of measures of medical distress. Have you skipped a doctor's appointment due to cost? Have you medical bankruptcies? Those are all way down. So the access to insurance that people have gotten have improved the readings and the measures of how of people's health and people's well-being. I think less well-known is the cost side of it, because that's a big part of the objection you get from the right. The bill was paid for, and a lot of people scoffed at the fact that it was paid for, but the Congressional Budget Office has revised downward its cost estimate for the Affordable Care Act's provisions, coverage provisions, numerous times, by hundreds of billions of dollars. The government's actually spending less than it was originally projected to spend. In fact, the federal government is spending less on health care now after Obamacare was passed than it was projected to spend in 2010 before Obamacare. So medical inflation has come down to the level that we actually can spend less than we were projected to spend and cover an additional 20 million people. Why has that happened? I think the bend the curve reforms that they introduced had really tremendous impact. They introduced comparative effectiveness research of different kinds of treatment rather than just going in the dark or what some lobbyist told doctors walking into their office, what they should use, what drug they should use, what treatment they should use. They actually had better funded research so people could say which treatments are actually doing the job. They started accountable care organizations so that instead of just having this model where doctors get paid for every treatment, you know, the more people come in, the more treatments you do, the more money you get. You care for patients and you're reimbursed on the basis of their well-being. You had other kinds of payment reforms. I think the easiest and clearest one to understand, and it's a great example of how the law has succeeded, is how hospitals were traditionally paid when someone got an infection in their hospital. Before, it was a second payday. You have the hospital, you have the patient. The patient gets infected in your hospital. They get sick. Where are they going to go? Back to the same hospital, because that's their hospital. Then the hospital makes more money. So they changed the rules of that. They gave these hospitals an incentive to reduce infections. And infections, as soon as that rule went into effect, the infection rate, which had been steady for decades, drops. 20,000 people a year now, fewer, are dying from infections in hospitals, and they're saving a lot of money because those are effective to treat. So you've had the lowest rate of medical inflation over the last several years in 50 years, and some of that is major, is large factors. It's how we can't pin down with experimental certainty what's causing that, but I think it's pretty strong evidence that a lot of these payment reforms actually have bent the curve, have changed the cost model, and have really freed up huge amounts of budget space and have resulted in these massive and unexpected savings in the healthcare sector. On climate. So first, in the stimulus, people didn't pay much attention, but they invested $90 billion in green energy, research, tax credits. And the cost of green energy technologies has been coming down. Over the last 8 years, wind and solar, they're down 50, 60, 75% in cost. In many parts of the country, it is cheaper to build wind turbine power plants, to build solar power plants, than it is to build coal or even natural gas. Emissions, greenhouse gas emissions, which had risen for decades, forever since industrialization, pretty much, peaked under Obama and have dropped and have continued to drop. And they built on the progress they made through a lot of those investments and changes. First, they made a bilateral deal with China in 2014 for both countries to reduce their emissions. And then they built on that to have the first international agreement to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. I actually think that'll probably be the most important legacy of this entire administration. And all those changes have an economic logic of their own and a diplomatic logic of their own that's continuing.
1 minute to go.
Sure. There are a few more medium-sized reforms that I think are important. Dodd-Frank was a tremendous change on Wall Street. The percentage of profit made by Wall Street financial firms was 30% of all corporate profits before the crisis. It's down to 17%, which is a little bit more than half. And the spread, the interest rate favorability by the two big to fail firms, which used to have an advantage, now have a disadvantage. They actually have higher interest rates to borrow. So it's now a penalty to be too big to fail rather than a benefit as it was before. So the law is working. I'll be extremely fast. Obama raised taxes on the rich, decreasing their income by 5%, and cut taxes on the lowest 10%, increasing their income by 9.7%. And there were really important education reforms, which maybe I'll talk about later.
Okay, thank you.
By the way, I lobbied to shorten my own time, so I'm completely to blame for this.
Won't count against you, Jonathan. Okay, you get 10 and a half minutes, so we're going to pull even to speak for the negative. Take it away. 10 and a half minutes for you, Matt.
I want to thank, and then since you forgot to at the beginning, can you give a round of applause to Gene Epstein here for organizing this? I figured starting by insulting you is going to really help out. And thanks to the Smith Family Foundation for this. And thanks to Jonathan for writing a particularly well-timed book for us to talk about. It came out today, by the way, and you can get copies over there, and I highly recommend it.
Very kind.
I would point out that the question on the table here, it's important to get a little bit lawyerly with this, is not whether Barack Obama was better president than the new weird guy coming in on Friday. The question is not whether he's got a pretty handsome and attractive family who seem like nice, kind of classy people compared to almost everybody else who has resided in the White House. It's not that. It's not whether we like his pop culture choices compared to George W. Bush's pop culture choices and all that kind of stuff. It is whether or not he was a great president. There is an affirmative that we need to prove here. Jonathan has given his level best. Let me give my piss take a little bit on some of that. I think that in order to be a great presidency, there are probably few exceptions, maybe one that I can think of off the top of my head, in which a presidency can be great, can be commonly discussed as great, in which it is not also associated with having a great achievement in foreign policy. Jonathan doesn't talk about this much. He has a foreign policy chapter. It's one of the most entertaining chapters because he knows he doesn't have a lot to work with. by which I mean he treats the subject very honestly and has some pretty interesting writing about choices that we make in the Middle East. One of the sentences here is, not being George W. Bush may not qualify as the pinnacle of historic achievement, but it certainly beats the alternative. I would suggest that not having a very obvious foreign policy gain really hurts the argument that this was a great presidency. And I think it is worth lingering a little bit on some of what happened in foreign policy. Recall that Barack Obama was ran as, I wouldn't say not a fully anti-war candidate, but an anti-dumb war candidate, right? We're going to do smart wars instead of dumb wars. He got a lot of the juice in his initial campaign based on the 2002 speech, early prescient against the Iraq war, and correctly so, I think. So what does he do as president? He immediately surges in Afghanistan. More than two-thirds of U.S. soldiers who have died in Afghanistan happened during the Obama presidency. Why? Really? Why? It's hard to fathom why. It's because he decided on the campaign that Iraq was the dumb war, Afghanistan was the smart war. So we surged there, even though the surge had an expiration date and that everyone knew to begin with. And so we are basically in the status quo, give or take, in Afghanistan right now. We have something like 8,000 troops. He's passing off that war. He's the first president to be at war every single day of his two-term presidency that we've had, as far as I know. These are human lives that have been lost for something that's actually kind of hard to explain in any rational sense. At the 2008 Democratic Convention, there was a lot of talk. We forget about this now in the mists of time, but that happened in the wake of Vladimir Putin aggressing against Georgia. And so Joe Biden stood up and said, we will not stand for this. We will hold Putin accountable for this, and we're going to start among other things, by treating them with a newfound respect and all these kind of things. Well, obviously, Vladimir Putin has not been held accountable for his expansionism in his near abroad. It's a hard question. Don't get me wrong about that. But the reset with Russia, much like George W. Bush's friendship with Vladimir Putin, turned out to be a big nothing burger, which I think was pretty predictable by a lot of people who've been paying attention to Russia for a long time. And now, and keep in mind, too, that the Obama administration was withdrawing troops and canceling missile deployment plans in the Czech Republic and Poland as kind of a sop to treating Vladimir Putin with respect. And in the waning hours of his presidency, we're just like throwing troops to Norway, we're throwing troops to Poland. So I think this was a strategic bungle, as we've seen with the behavior of Putin in this election, which certainly has been controversial. I would also put in this category of the intervention in Libya, which lowered a very, very low bar to begin with of when we intervene in a place. We intervene in Libya because we wanted to prevent a massacre that we thought might happen in this one city. And I don't mean to say that in a way that underplays the horrible devastation of Muammar Gaddafi or what was going to happen in that city, but that was our casus belli. There wasn't any other reason to do this. We went in, we deposed a dictator, and helped create an incredibly chaotic dynamic in the Middle East. And we did so, keep in mind, this is the presidential candidate who's told Charlie Savage, the great civil liberties reporter, now for the New York Times, then for the Boston Globe, that of course a President Obama would not seek to create war abroad without getting congressional approval. So much did he flout that imperative at the time is that when Congress came back to him after even more than 60 days, which is supposed to be the cutoff, and said, hey, bro, we're supposed to vote on this one. He said, well, it's not actually any kind of warlike thing. It's a kinetic military action. So it's in a different category. And this kind of gets into, I think, a big disappointment of about Barack Obama, not just to libertarians, but to a lot of people, is that the promise of Obamaism was this was the constitutional law professor. He was going to roll back the aggrandizement of the executive branch of government. That was a big deal. Look at the bestseller list from 2007. That was the subject, right? And so he said he's going to do this. It's going to be the most transparent administration in history, and on and on. And he's serially, beginning with deciding not to release the Abu Ghraib photos, which he had promised a lot to do in 2009, he serially went back on that promise. He did not have the most transparent administration. I'm happy that my friends in the press are now getting excited about the president of the United States, and that's a little bit unfair because some free press groups have been pretty tough on Obama as well. But he used the Espionage Act in all kinds of ways. Although, did everyone hear? He commuted the Chelsea Manning's sentence today. So this happened right before we started. So if that undercuts my argument, I'm very sorry, but I just want to spread the news in this room. So this promise of this constitutionalist guy, I think in many ways, failed. And he's leaving Donald Trump with a more loaded gun when it comes to executive power than he would have otherwise had. And that's kind of the opposite of what the promise was going in. Think about this in terms of the drug war, which is something that I pay some attention to, you would think that a guy who was in the Chum Gang might not openly be laughing at anyone who would ask him a question about maybe legalized marijuana or tolerate states who have done so. He immediately passed George W. Bush's record in terms of raiding medical marijuana dispensaries in his first term before, rightly and thankfully, turning the other cheek eventually after Colorado and Washington legalized. But it's these promises of what he could have been he failed to deliver. So what that leaves you with, I think, is John's big three, which are stimulus, Obamacare, and global warming. I would point out that on stimulus, so it's the great unknowable. He prevented a Great Depression. We can't run the counterfactual here. I can say, in order to introduce a little bit of doubt to that narrative, that if you are looking for people who said at the time that the stimulus as enacted, the $800 billion level, would lead to or might lead to disappointing Japan-style growth. You would have, among other people, maybe all three of us on this stage, but I think John and I, we ran a cover at Reason in 2009, obviously because I'm Gen X, turning Japanese, a picture of Obama with chopsticks. It was probably racist, and I'm sorry for that in retrospect. But the notion that libertarians and anti-stimulus people had at the time, which is if you just throw a bunch of new government spending out, and it's not really done in the Keynesian way of like inject it and then withdraw it. It's just inject it. We've got a new ratchet. Let's go. If you do that, we're going to lead to this period of stagnant, disappointing growth. The other people were saying that were Paul Krugman and Christine Romer, who explicitly warned Barack Obama in 2009, if we don't stimulus enough, if we don't go at a trillion and a half. So I think that points to the problem with the counterfactual. We can't know. We just can't whether this prevented the Great Depression or not. I want to believe that it did, honestly, because I want the policies that were enacted to be good. But I don't think that we can prove it, and we can't base the greatness of a presidency on a counterfactual, and we can look at the stimulus and some of the promises associated with it, that it's going to be 90% of the jobs are going to be from the private sector and such like. They didn't come close to coming through. Obamacare, one-third of the country has a choice of one insurer right now. Two-thirds of the co-ops have already collapsed. The thing is going to get repealed in a couple of days or a couple of weeks. Which is not Obama's fault necessarily, but his role in creating this law as structured made it vulnerable at the Supreme Court level. It led to the death spirals that people have worried about. So I don't think it is as cracked up as an unalloyed good as John Chait
I think you've had
presents
10,
it.
Have you had 10 and a half minutes? No, yes. 10. Give you 10 more seconds. Go ahead.
10 more seconds. The biggest contributor to cutting carbon in America has been fracking.
Thank you. Okay, yes. Okay. We now have 19 minutes for polite conversation between our two antagonists. Jonathan, no doubt you want to say a few things, so why don't you start?
So it's 5 minutes and then 5 minutes?
No, a little conversation, free-flowing conversation, such as you suggested. So go ahead, speak your piece. Matt will respond.
Sorry, I thought we were going to do 5 minutes and 5 minutes, then conversation.
Okay, you want the 5 minutes, take the 5 minutes. He's going to want the top 5 minutes.
So the case in my book is that Obama was basically an average foreign policy president. He had some successes. Cuba, Iran is a really good success. He had some failures. The transformation came on the domestic side. So in a sense, you're just giving me the flip side of the argument that I'm making in my book, and that's the argument that I'm endorsing. I'm not saying that he's a Franklin Roosevelt in foreign policy, but on domestic policy, he really is. You're right that counterfactuals are hard, but we do make predictions. In 2012, you wrote, "The true cost of our current size of government is more stupid politics and a protracted recession." You talked about how Obama spends the rest of the time talking about the various things the government needs to invest to create, quote, broad-based growth, scare quotes. It is a conflict at the basic level of vision between those of us who think prosperity is mostly a private sector affair that is unbalanced, imperiled, not improved by the exertions of a deficit spending government. Well, we're out of the recession, and we have broad-based growth. Median income grew 5% in 2015, and it's tracking to the same thing, which is one of the highest rates of improvement for average people. So it's not just a matter of counterfactuals. I think we have evidence that the economy is performing better than people who didn't believe in stimulus thought it would. On Obamacare, I don't accept that it's facing repeal. You've had six Republican senators express concerns or outright opposition to repeal without replace, and there's never going to be a replace because Republicans have had 7 years to come up with a replace, and they still haven't. So without replace, no repeal. So, you know, I'm not giving this law up for dead. By the way, S&P did a recent analysis of the exchanges, and they found that you had a one-time price correction in the exchanges because insurers priced their premiums way too low, way lower than originally forecast, and now they're back up to the level of the original forecast. And S&P said it's basically stable, which is why enrollment increased, and you showed no signs whatsoever of a death spiral. How much more time do I have?
3 minutes.
Oh, wow. Fast. There's really no evidence that you have a ratchet in spending from the stimulus. You actually had a one-time bump in spending, and it went back down. I don't really know why you're saying that it wasn't stimulus. It was Keynesian stimulus. It was one-time injection of spending that receded, which is why the deficit is a third of the level it was in 2010.
We went from 2.7 trillion, just or 2.8 trillion, I think, in Bush's last budget, to 3.6 or thereabouts in Obama's. It hasn't gone below 3.6, as far as I know.
Okay, just as a quick factual
introduction. Another question, okay. But finish with your remarks, and you'll address that.
I can address a little bit of the foreign policy. You know, I think you're giving short shrift to the things that they did well. I think the Iran nuclear deal was a really important achievement. I think. So I'll do a rebuttal of the comedian. I'll do a rebuttal of the crowd. I'll do a rebuttal of that. I'll get everyone.
The comedian was just a joke. He's completely ignored his arguments. That comedian.
I'm joking. Exactly. Syria was a mess. Libya, they saved tens of thousands of people who Gaddafi is saying I'm going to slaughter them like rats very, very soon. They saved those people, but. You know, they didn't have conditions to put in a stable government afterwards. I think I'm still glad they did what they did. It didn't work out quite as well. I guess I have to disagree that to be a great president, as it's commonly defined, to say, like, that guy was a really great president, you have to have a huge foreign policy success. I'm also wondering why a libertarian would say that, because who are the great foreign policy presidents in American history? Usually the ones who won big wars. I don't think you should have to have that kind of foreign policy achievement to be considered a president who, in the common vernacular, was great.
Well, Ronald Reagan was okay.
Are you done?
So 5 minutes.
Okay, 5 minutes for you, Matt. Take it away. You want to address the stimulus, perhaps? Go ahead. Pick up your private.
So, as I was saying before, spending at the end of George W. Bush's term was $2.8 trillion, give or take, and someone will fact check me out there, went to $3.6 trillion under Obama, and it kind of has been in that ballpark ever since, 3.6, 3.7, 3.8, 3.9.
As a percentage of GDP, though, it's gone back. It's down about 4%.
Yeah, I'm just counting the number. I'm counting the number, and GDP's I'm also pointing out that Barack Obama, in his original State of the Union address in 2009, devoted, as he had done on the campaign, quite a few paragraphs talking about the necessity of cutting down debt. In fact, that's what John beats him up the most for in the book, is his participation in Simpson-Bowles and debt reduction things, which I, because we disagree about a lot of fundamental things, think that's one of the great successes of the Obama presidency. But Barack Obama campaigned on a net spending cut. He said that in the third debate with John McCain after the financial crisis had hit. He talked about not kicking the can down the road on entitlements under his watch. In the January 2009 interview with the Washington Post, at the end of his presidency, he's saying we need to expand Social Security and make our benefits more generous. He's yielded to the Bernie Sanders wing of the party on that. He described George W. Bush's expansion of debt as un-American, his words, not mine, when George W. Bush doubled it from 5 trillion, or it doubled under his watch, 5 trillion to 10 trillion. It is effectively doubled under Barack Obama's watch, 10 trillion to 20 trillion. Any congressional budget office look at the long-term budget outlook, or even semi-near-term budget outlook, looks like the Edward Munch painting. It is grim reading. The next president, and it is Donald Trump, God help us, is going to face, and I know some of you voted for him, whatever, is going to face having debt service eclipse the amount of money that we spend on military spending. That's going to happen in like 3 or 4 years, according to the Congressional Budget Office. We are getting to unprecedented levels of indebtedness. And for those who don't think that's a problem, I envy how you sleep at night, because that works out great. But for the rest of us who know that occasionally interest rates do go up, when that moment happens, we're going to look back and say, what did we do? What did we do, not just during Barack Obama's presidencies, but George W. Bush's presidency very much? I see the two of them in tandem, certainly on this issue and maybe on a couple of others. That is a failure. And he did, yes, try to create this grand bargain and all this kind of stuff, and it did fall apart, leading to the sequestration cuts, which is one of the only good things that happened. That stimulus ended up being on net a ratchet. We got to a new plateau of spending, and we're still there. And we're there for the few. The congressional Republicans just passed, you know, a 10-year thing that we're going to add $9 trillion in new spending out there. I think that is going to hang over the Obama legacy the moment that interest rates go up.
So the main point Obama was making about long-term debt from the beginning was that mostly we have a healthcare cost problem. Healthcare costs are eating up a larger and larger share of the budget. And that was why he became interested in the Simpsons Bowl plan that you said. But healthcare reform turned out to be entitlement reform, because Medicare was a big part of the changes in Obamacare. And I know you didn't agree with it when it passed. You said it significantly expands federal responsibility and raises the cost curve. You said that the numbers were pulled out of Joe Biden's pants and will be dwarfed by actual costs within a year or two, was what you wrote at the time. But in fact, actual costs have come in not at target, below target. And the slowing down and the change of healthcare spending has had a dramatic effect on the budget. In fact, where the long-term budget, the long-term deficit, is below the level that Simpson-Bowles was targeting. So I know you're sad that Simpson-Bowles failed, but you could be happy that we actually succeeded in hitting the target they were shooting for anyway through the slowdown in healthcare costs.
I'm not happy with the long-term outlook of the federal budget. And part of that wasn't just bending that particular cost curve. It was also addressing Social Security and raising retirement ages and doing a whole lot of things that were on the table then and are just not. And they're not politically by either party. Donald Trump ran screaming against that. Between 1997 and 2013, every single State of the Union address, every one, you have to count some of them as an address to the joint session when it's in their first year, but whatever. Every single one mentioned long-term entitlement reform as a pressing issue. That stopped since then. It used to be a thing. It's no longer a thing in two-party politics in America. I think that's going to come back to bite us in the rear. And those weren't the original thing that you quoted from mine. Those weren't scare quotes. Those were just quotes. My scare quotes would be more like pants or something like that.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'll read the quote if you want, but no.
You already did. I think we're good.
Yeah. Jonathan, perhaps you want to elaborate on your points about carbon dioxide emissions. Matt made the point about that fracking has really been the main thing that's addressed that problem.
Absolutely.
Go ahead, yes.
No, there's no question that the fracking changes have given us a lot of breathing time to reduce emissions. It's less than half the change in the reduction of emissions, but it's a big part of it. And the degree to which it's a part of the change is reducing is smaller going forward. So it's a big part of the initial jump, but the degree to which it's contributing to emissions is shrinking a bit.
Do you think the Obama administration has made wind and solar power viable and competitive and the wave of the future in terms of real cost-based investment? Has that happened?
Yeah, I think it has happened. The $90 billion that were invested in the stimulus have yielded just tremendous results in terms of making those technologies affordable and spreading rapidly. You know, you're talking about 10 times the penetration of these technologies as before. And again, in many parts of the country, it's cheaper. The only advantage that coal has is that the plants are already built. It's if you're building a new plant, it's much cheaper to build either gas or wind or solar. And wind and solar are coming down so fast that in many of those increasing numbers of those areas, it's wind and solar. Tesla is rolling out an all-electric car that's basically going to be price competitive with gasoline-powered cars in the next 2 years, and a lot of the other companies are following suit. So I think you're seeing tremendous success in the investment in these technologies. They knew they didn't have time to just wait for the market on its own to develop everything because emissions are rising globally so fast. You have to speed up the adaptation curve, and I think they've had enormous success in getting that.
I see. Matt, would you grant, perhaps you want to comment on that, but my question to you is, would you grant Jonathan's one claim that Obama's nuclear deal with Iran was a plus?
I don't know. I don't think he knows. I don't think anyone here knows. I know you all have strong opinions about it. I don't think we can know until 5 years from now, 10 years elapses, and did they build one or did they not? We know that it prevented a run-up to hostilities, military hostilities between them. And I know a lot of people, myself included, are happy not to see us go to war again. We also know that it freed up a lot of money to one of the nastier regimes in the world, and they've spent it in their usual nasty ways as well. I think we don't know. I am much more willing to grant a non-alloyed good, and I know some of you disagree out there, with what Obama has done with Cuba. With ending restrictions or limiting restrictions on what Americans can do in Cuba, which strikes me as a ridiculous policy we had for 50 years. I wish that he would have gotten more concessions from the other side, but it was good to do just on our own. And I think those policies have been good. In the scheme of things, when you're facing a world in which our biggest threat is probably the sort of, I wouldn't say existential, but big threat from spreading Islamic terror, and then sort of the biggest other challenge is the kind of expansion revanchism of Vladimir Putin. I don't think that we can say that he moved the needle in a very positive direction on those two big challenges.
I think the sanctions on Russia were tremendously effective. I agree. That's it. I'm gonna disagree with you about Obamacare being rolled back. The sanctions on Russia, yeah, they're probably toast. I don't see Donald Trump being tremendously committed to holding up that sanctions regime against Putin, to say the least. But that worked. Those were measures short of war, which a lot of the hawks were criticizing for Obama for not doing, for not arming Ukraine, for not using military measures. But those were strong economic sanctions that dealt a pretty devastating blow to Russia's economy.
I want to jump onto the fracking thing. I mean, something like 68% of the change in carbon emissions has to do with swapping out energy sources, and the biggest part of that by far is swapping out fracking for coal. The majority of that has been market driven. It hasn't, you know, Obama's war on coal has been oversold by quite a lot. It is because fracking got cheaper. He didn't get in the way substantially of fracking. I don't think he was holding big cheerleading celebrations on the White House front lawn about fracking. Certainly, that's not a popular topic among Democratic Party, particularly in the state that we're in. But that points to something about Obama, which I think is interesting, and I think will make Jonathan's book a little bit prescient, especially his one of his final chapters, which talks about how liberals are always disappointed in every single Democratic president until they're out of office, then they love them, which is true, and it's funny. And I think it's definitely already starting to happen with Obama. He will be given credit for stuff he didn't really do a lot to do, right? He will be given credit for gay marriage, which he opposed for a really long time, and then let Joe Biden go do the trial alone. He will be given credit, I swear to you, about pot, even though he was terrible on this issue until basically Colorado and Washington forced his hand. In some key moments, and this is not a small thing, I give him credit for this, he did not step in the way of the progress that Americans were making on their own, but he didn't lead for them. And I think that's true also of fracking. That's an important role for a president, not to muck things up, but he didn't lead on those issues. And I think it's interesting just to observe.
So I agree on one thing, and I say in my book that I don't give him credit on gay marriage. I think that was something that happened organically and as a result of the courts, where he's commonly given credit, and I don't really mention that as an achievement. I think there's a lot of things that he's done that people don't understand, don't appreciate. Education reform, I didn't get to it because I used my time poorly in the opening session, but that might even be something with which you have some agreement. Yeah. In the stimulus, they had a grant called Race to the Top, where it was, I think, a $9 billion reward for states to reform their systems. And the genius of this grant is it only went to the winners. So, like,
30 states say, here's what we did. Do we win? And they say, no, only five of you win. And so they leveraged huge amounts of change. They only gave the money to a fraction. And so you've had this tremendous proliferation of standards, of accountability measures, of charter schools that and you never talk about it. And the reason is that the teachers' unions hate it. And Obama needs the teachers' unions to come out and vote. So he never talks about it. And Republicans, who might be inclined to like it, never want to admit Obama did something they like. So neither side has any incentive to talk about this tremendous change in public education that's actually, if you follow education policy, I think you'll find is actually one of the most dramatic reforms and improvements that you're seeing in so many of these states. That is something that I think you're going to see continue to go on for decades.
I'm not sure, though. Ultimately, it's a drop in the bucket compared to how much stimulus money went out to bail out local state governments so that they could keep keep in their 80% spending increases back when times were good and to take care of their teacher pension obligations, things like that. I mean, Race to the Top is small. It did change behavior. It's a good thing. I agree with Jonathan on, but the lasting element of it, I think, is pointed to by the way Hillary Clinton, his designated successor, ran about education reform, which is to say she was steadfastly against it and talked about education like a 1975 liberal, and not even in a good 1975 liberal way, in a bad one. Yeah. And I think that speaks to something that we should also look at here. A truly successful president, you can't always just point at scoreboard on this stuff, but Barack Obama, from the time that he came office to the time he left office, Democratic Party, which he is the most visible figurehead, and we have, unfortunately, a very presidential-heavy system out there. Democratic Party has lost 60 congresspeople, around 10 senators, around 12 governorships, a bunch of state houses as well. Democraticness has been discredited as a governing idea under his watch. I think that part of his legacy points to that there isn't the legacy ultimately is people seeing in him what they want to see and thinking that he's still this kind of glamorous character who agrees with me about the stuff that I care about. But there isn't a lot of lasting institutional reform that's going to or good stuff that's going to last because of what he
did. I want to respond to that. So the last five presidents have left Congress in opposing party control because there's a natural thermostatic response of the public about which party they support, and it works its way out at the local level. Ron Brownstein of The Atlantic actually measured the number of gubernatorial seats, Senate seats, in other down-ballot measures, and basically Obama's right in the middle. So this idea that he had some historic collapse, it's just not true. He's just right in the middle. And the fact that he's at 60%, I think, tells you more about what the public thinks about him.
Okay, we are going to have people line up. Thank you, Jonathan. Line up to ask questions. We have 30 minutes for that. As you're lining up, I just want to throw out one question as moderator and, I guess, as somebody who covers the economy. Main question, I guess, is for you, Jonathan, with Matt to comment. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office has been warning for years, year after year, that the debt is out of control. They keep stating that the direction in which we're going, we could face a fiscal crisis. As recently as August of last year, they issued the same warning. This was after all that Obama did. The same warning that we face a fiscal crisis, the debt is running out of control. This was their 30-year projection. Does that bother you at all that the warning and the danger still exists according to the nonpartisan CBO?
So the best measure we have of that is interest rates. When debt starts to crowd out private capital, interest rates will rise. That's what happened in the early 90s. That's what forced Washington to act on the budget deal, the bipartisan budget deal of 1990, the one that the Republicans revolted against. And that actually is what shaped the modern Republican Party. George Bush says, interest rates are starting to go up. We need a budget deal. He goes to the Democrats. They say, we're not going to put all the sacrifice in the middle class. The rich have to pay their share. Bush ultimately agrees. The entire congressional right-wing caucus revolts against him. And since then, they've said, we will never make a deal like that. That's the worst thing any president has ever done. No new taxes is our religion. And that's it now and forever. So I think that's an important context, not because I'm trying to point the finger at that, but that tells you those are the circumstances under which you have to and usually will act. And I think that's shaped the politics of long-term debt. Because when you have one party that refuses on principle to accede to any revenue increase of any kind, and Obama tried in every possible way to get them to trade higher revenue for spending cuts. He went to John Boehner in private, in public, commissions, super commissions, everything, every other way. It's just religion in the Republican Party. And I don't see how it's incumbent on the Democrats when you're looking at the United States being one of the lowest tax countries in the advanced world. In fact, if we were simply an average tax country, our debt problem would disappear, for them to go along with an all spending cut solution with a party that simply refuses to put revenue on the table.
The Federal Reserve has put a pillow over the face of interest rates now for 7 years. And when we lift the pillow, we're going to wonder what the hell we were doing.
Thank you, Matt. Okay. First question, please frame your question as a question. And please tell us who the question is addressed to, if you can. Please take it away.
I'd like Mr. Chait to answer this. I'm going to put out a few ideas with regard to Obamacare that I'd like you to comment on. And so the question would be, how do you regard these ideas? You defended Obama by saying that he succeeded by his own measures or by his own standards. And I would argue that for Obamacare, that he fell very short of his own standards. He campaigned first against the mandate. That was a Hillary Clinton idea. He campaigned against the mandate in 2008. He thought that the mandate was unworkable or was authoritarian, these types of he didn't use that term, but he campaigned against it because he thought it was restrictive, one. Two, the ultimate system obviously included mandates, but they've been continued to be deferred by him through executive orders. So he's not even carrying through these what the law is saying. He's deferring implementation of the law because they're unworkable and they would create a political backlash ahead of the 2016 election. Three, things like the CLASS Act, which was a long-term care benefit, it collapsed before it could even be implemented. It never even got funded because it was unworkable from a financial standpoint. And on and on, that the co-ops collapsing, that the main thing that he campaigned on was that he was going to transcend politics, these kind of political definitions. Not a single Republican voted for Obamacare. It was the first piece of social legislation in our history that didn't have bipartisan support, as Social Security and Medicare, Medicaid did. So I'd like you to comment on some of these.
Thanks for your question. Okay, take it away.
Thank you.
The main goal of the legislation was to increase access and decrease the cost curve. And the CLASS Act was a little, side program that Ted Kennedy was into, so it got to go in there, and they decided it wasn't going to work. The co-ops, again, were a hobby horse of Ken Conrad, a couple other senators. Those don't work, but those were never anything even close to integral or central to the law's functioning. So that's why I say the law is doing the two main goals that he articulated over and over again, which was to bend down the cost curve and increase access to health insurance. It worked. It's true that the Republican Party refused to support this legislation. It's true Republicans met before Obama's inauguration and planned out a strategy that was totally successful on its own terms, where they said, if we avoid putting our fingerprints on any of his legislation, it will be seen as partisan. That will make it unpopular. That will give us our best chance to regain power. And they were right about that. I think the Republicans came up with a very clever political tactic, which no one had ever quite had the guts to execute to that degree before. But that doesn't mean that Obama is responsible for their choices. And again, Mitt Romney is the one who set up the prototype for the healthcare law. Mitt Romney actually ran on a national version of his healthcare plan in 2008, and lots of conservatives were totally happy with it. You had conservative publications saying, oh, look at all these great things he's done with healthcare. He's going to do this at the national level. This will give our party a chance to win. Once Obama had embraced this model, then they decided that these elements, and especially the mandate, which Romney was endorsing very strongly, was the most authoritarian thing the government had done. So I think the Republican calculation, which proved correct, was that if they opposed everything Obama did, they could drive high levels of opposition. And I think that has continued to reverberate among supporters of the party. But I think that's just something where you have to credit Republicans for coming up with a clever strategy.
Matt? Yeah.
Just toss in a couple minor things. I think it's worth pointing out and worth criticizing that in the passage of the law, I think Obama acted with a mendacity that did not resonate with the same kind of claims that he was making about being sort of a new kind of politician, saying that you can keep your doctor, you can keep your insurance, saying that, you know, a dozen times that premiums are going to go down for a family by 2,500.
They went down by more, 5,000.
I'll be happy to look at your math. That sounds okay. that sounds great.
Because you've had the slowest healthcare growth in 50 years.
And then also continuously saying that this is a victory of the people over the special interests, as if the healthcare industry hadn't out-lobbied the opposition to this 5-1, which they did throughout, and the pharmaceutical industry was part of that. That irritated me strongly as someone who was following events at the time.
Okay, next question.
So I was also struck by your reference, Jonathan, to Obama's accomplishments in relation to his own standards. So let me just mention three news stories that I'm sure you're familiar with. One is the Fast and Furious gun walking program from a few years ago. A second is the wiretapping of James Rosen's telephone. And the third is the IRS targeting of Tea Party groups. What does it say about Obama's standards that he says that those aren't scandals? And how can a great president, how can a president be great who claims that those things aren't scandals?
There was no IRS targeting of Tea Party groups. There was no IRS targeting of Tea Party groups. It was fully investigated. And they found out left-wing groups had been investigated by the exact same standard, the exact same degree. This is a myth that lives on in right-wing media. This is a fantasy. It's not true whatsoever. I mean, I realize Republicans need to have a scandal in their brains that they think happened, but this was a non-event. They took it seriously. They look at it. They investigate, and they found out there was no different treatment of the right-wing groups than left-wing groups.
Please. Civility is the three mottos of the Soho Forum, so please keep it civil, or my goons are going to be clearing you out of the hall very shortly. Matt, take it away.
Without adjudicating that claim, since you guys seem to have it under control here, I would point out that a bunch of journalists from the AP had their phones tapped, and as I mentioned before, and the James Risen thing is an example of this, the Obama administration has been incredibly disappointing on this, blocking Freedom of Information Act requests, prosecuting, trying to subpoena information from reporters so that they cough up their sources, cracking down on whistleblowers. All of this has been would be disappointing for any president, but particularly for a president who is showered prematurely, not unlike he was with the Nobel Peace Prize, but from transparency groups about being a wonderful transparency president before he actually did much of anything, and it's a sign that he wasn't that person.
Okay. Next question.
First of all, thanks a lot for doing this. I love that it's two blocks from my house. You guys are all wonderful. I'd like for you both to touch on briefly race relations in America and how Obama was either a leader or not.
Okay, so time's up. So we're good.
What'd you say? Matt, you can take that first because Jonathan's gone first.
Jesus Christ. Actually, Jonathan's chapter on this was super interesting, so I want you to start. I'm serious. It was.
Okay, yeah, he can insist that you go. Jonathan, go ahead.
I do have a chapter on race because that's the first thing that people are going to remember about Barack Obama, despite the depth and breadth of his accomplishments 200 years from now. At first, I think he was uncertain in how he handled it, how you had the Shirley Sherrod case where you had this misleading video on Breitbart that was trying to make it appear as if this African-American civil servant was discriminating against white people, where they cut off the part of the video where she said that's not what she was doing and she was treating everyone equally. Obama was so scared by this attack, they fired her before they had all the facts. That was them being uncertain in the face of this backlash that they faced. But I think over the course of the presidency, they got sounder footing. And it's kind of hard to summarize, but I think what Obama did with race. What I try to argue in my book is that race wasn't just something that happened to Obama, but something he did. I think he managed to weave the story of racial progress, of civil rights, into the heart of the American story in a way no previous president had. That he tells the story of America as a story of progress in which civil rights, the fight against slavery, is integral to, in fact, the epitome of the American story. And I think that's actually a change in our civic culture that's going to last for a long time.
Your comment?
I have found myself in his second term particularly disappointed with which the way that he and his administration in moments of high stress that we've had basically since Ferguson, right? That changed the way that we talk about stuff in this country, in the media, on college campuses and whatnot. Some of the best things that the Obama administration has done is the Department of Justice's investigations into places like Ferguson, the facts that they've conjured up there, showing patterns of policing for profit, shaking down poor communities, prosecutorial abuse, and these kind of things. Those are and also pointing out that a lot of what people were saying about the case at hand is myth. That's not how it went down, and calling into question a lot of narratives that you might otherwise hear on MSNBC. Those were good things. In many moments, I think the president went towards race quicker in these last couple of years than he did towards what we could have done in a real moment that we have had, and I hope that we still have, but I worry that we don't, of possibilities of criminal justice reform. Some of the reforms that could have happened, you can't take a policy and go into someone's heart and twist the key on the policy and they stop being a racist. But what you can do is you can stop having the federal judiciary, the federal criminal justice apparatus, take eyewitness testimony so seriously. Take bullshit forensic. Can we say that on C-SPAN? Forensic, bite mark crap. Things like that. Thank you. We've known a lot of those reforms. What you do when you take the power away from people who may or may not be racist but may use their power in ways that have disproportionate effects, well, go after the power. I feel like that the president, who is in an awful, very difficult spot, to put it mildly, when it comes to race relations in this country, when looking at criminal justice reform, has made it more about race relations than he has about criminal justice reform in his rhetorical approach towards that. And I fear that has led to us not taking advantage of this moment to do more than we actually could have done. The end.
Okay, next question.
Cool. Just really a point of clarification on the question of the debate from Mr. Chait. Thinking about President Obama, after 8 years, after 7 countries bombed, after 26,000 bombs lobbed to various countries in the Middle East over the last couple of years, to Doctors Without Borders Hospital being bombed in Afghanistan by the United States, by a 16-year-old American boy, an American citizen, being assassinated by our country in the Middle East, with a Yemeni wedding being bombed, how can you reconcile all the things that have happened with foreign policy with this president and still say, this man is great, this man is moral, he's done things that if I were president, I would press that button as commander-in-chief and kill thousands and thousands of innocent people?
When Obama, so this does relate to what I said, which is succeeding by the standards he set out for himself. He didn't run on ratcheting down the war against radical Islam. He ran on ratcheting it up. If you remember the presidential debate with McCain, he said, I'm going to go into Pakistan. I'm going to get Osama bin Laden. And McCain said, you can't go to Pakistan. That's crazy. We're not going into Pakistan. That would start a war. You know, we can't violate their integrity. He said, that's what I'm going to do. He decided he was going to change the focus of George W. Bush's response to the 9/11 attacks. He didn't say it would be painless. He didn't say there would be no casualties. And there were. But I think there's a persuasive argument to be made that for all the horrors of war, when you are in a war, that they've chosen the least terrible path to prosecute it.
We're at war with a half dozen countries. Lord knows even what we're doing in Yemen. I can't probably find Yemen on a map, which probably says something about me. But it's also kind of a problem when we're constantly at undeclared wars and we're doing it forget the drone thing. We're just doing it. The president is given a list. You know, he's given a kill list. That's what he's handing over to Donald Trump. That's what, when I said earlier he's handing Donald Trump a loaded gun, this is exactly what I meant. We have now established as kind of a normal thing that a president will have a kill list and that there isn't really any territorial integrity that we need respect out there in the world. That is an incredibly, I think, ultimately pretty dangerous place to be, because there's going to come a time sooner rather than later when we're not the only people who control skies, who control drones out there. We don't want to be in a place where weddings are going to be subject to these types of things. I agree with the premise of the question.
Next questioner, please.
Despite Obama's rhetoric for more of an open immigration policy, last week he increased restrictions on Cuban refugees, and Cuban immigrants in Florida tend to vote Republican. What do you think of this move? Is this a shrewd political move, or does this make him great?
Do you want to take it?
I'll take it, just to irritate people. So anything that the Castros like, you want to say is bad, and it probably on some level is. On the other hand, something like 50,000 Cubans walked across the U.S.-Mexico border last year. And when you get across the border, if you're from Cuba, you originate from there. Unlike people from anywhere else, you are given a check. You are given pathway to citizenship. Yeah, you can access to all kinds of things, benefits from the U.S. welfare state. A lot of Cubans, including Marco Rubio, including Carlos Curbelo, I'm sorry, I forget, have been, and then the South Sentinel, Sun Sentinel in South Florida, have been writing about the abuses of the system. A lot of Cubans have been coming across the border knowing they can get all this stuff, say, sweet, I'm a refugee, I'm on the clock, I'm going back to Havana. This is great. So, yes, it has been a precondition from the Castros from a long time, and screw the damn Castros. I agree with that. At the same time, what they're doing with this policy is making Cuba like Venezuela. You know, there can be a response, why don't we make everyone more like Cuba? And I'm willing to have that argument, but I understand the policy. Jeff Flake, who last time I looked is not a Democrat and is not a fan of commies, said this is a great move, as did some other people as well. As usual, Obama in these negotiations doesn't get a lot from the other end, and that is irritating in a moment when Cuba's cracked down on a lot of people and still has a lot of people in jail. But the move on its face of it, even though it's an immigration restriction and I don't like them as a thing, it makes a certain amount of sense.
Argument?
You know, I don't want to argue, but I do want to point out that I think Matt has in this answer and many others, has shown a lot of integrity. He's not using every answer to try to score every point he can. I think he's trying to illuminate the audience. I think he's trying to answer the questions honestly. And so I just wanted to say, this answer especially, I think, you know, he deserves a lot of credit for showing a lot of
integrity. Okay, we feel the love between these two guys.
That makes me feel uncomfortable.
Let's get the next question so we can get some disagreement going.
Hi there. So the gentleman earlier took my question about race relations, but there's another area that sees a lot of tension and political relations. Obama was supposed to unite the country. You know, every president says that they plan to do that, but this was really hit like his kind of a big platform of his. It feels like there's more tension than ever after his presidency. So how do you see his legacy playing out there?
He's at 60% approval now. Clearly people like him.
I don't believe polls anymore.
Sorry, what?
I don't believe polls anymore.
Well, don't believe polls, but the final polls missed by about 1%. The final polls had Hillary Clinton winning by 3%. She won by 2.1. So if the polls are off by 1%, so okay, Obama's only at 59%. You're not going to find a polling error on the scale that's going to get that wrong. There was an intense racialization to the backlash against Obama. There's a huge I try to make the point in my book that people who oppose him have good ideological reasons to do it, and those reasons need to be taken seriously. Nonetheless, it is demonstrably the case that a major source of the actual support for, or the actual opposition to him, came from race. And I think, look at Donald Trump. Look at Donald Trump. If you think the Tea Party was really about limited government and constitutional principles, if you think that's what was motivating this mass upsurge in hate toward Obama, Donald Trump is the answer. Donald Trump is the antithesis of all those values. Donald Trump won the Republican nomination by being the most racist. In fact, by being the only racist in the race. I don't think social scientists who looked at the correlation between racism and politics in the Obama era found that everything became racialized, and the degree to which people's racial views correlated with their political views became nearly total under Obama to a much greater degree than it was before. Again, I say in the book that there are plenty of times when people on the left, people on my side, overlearn this point, accuse people of harboring racial bias for making a statement that they could have just as easily made about a white Democrat. And that's happened a lot. And I think people on the right have good reason to be aggravated that they're being tarred in this way. And I think people deserve the right as an individual to have their ideas being treated seriously and not have their motives interrogated and made assumptions about why they're saying what they say. Nonetheless, if you want to look on the aggregate at the American public as a whole, I think it's impossible to deny that racism became a huge motivating force to the opposition.
I want to apologize to Jonathan Chait for all the heckling. But
I love it. It gives me strength.
Okay. Then I guess I don't have to apologize.
Bring it on.
Matt, take it away. Briefly, what do you want to say?
Briefly, to answer your question, I think one of the more irritating tics of Obama, and this is and also on the kind of category of disappointment, precisely because of the way that he came on the American stage, is that he was forever portraying what he would describe as false choices, and then he would make a false choice of his own. He was always defining, like, well, some would say that America shouldn't spend any money doing this. And then other people say America should spend all of their money. Well, I'm going to spend the middle amount. He was the Goldilocks guy constantly. And in doing that, and this is pretty consistent in his rhetoric and also when he would get irritated, the way that he would describe the people, the tenors of both sides at any given moment weren't necessarily accurate. As soon as you're on the opposite side personally of an important issue that Obama was talking a lot about, you discovered that your position was being caricatured. I wouldn't say as bad as the person waving around a long form birth certificate, but you were being caricatured a hell of a lot. And that in the same breath that he was saying that we've got to stop making false choices and we've got to stop caricaturing people. And so that tick was irritating, whether or not how much discredit or credit I want to give him for the increasing polarization. We are in a long, big sort, people, and we are right now in a really weird moment where there's a split between the cosmopolitans and the countryside. The city mice and country mice are really kind of going in their respective corners right now, and a lot of conflict in American politics in a way that's kind of new in the modern era is happening, and that's also repeating out in Europe. That's weird, and I don't know how much that would have happened anyways if Barack Obama was a different person or whatever, but I don't think that he rose to the moment in the way that he treated people with differing points of view. I think he caricaturized the opposition in a given moment.
Thank you for the question. Next question, please.
I'm sorry that my friend actually just took my question before, because I'm a Cuban American and I rarely am upset with your response, but I think I take it a little bit personally because I'm a Cuban American. I just want to go into a little bit about why do you consistently use the CBO? Because every single time I see the CBO as a standard, it's good garbage in, garbage out. But more importantly, we've had a GDP at 1.2, 1.5, less than 3, and over 100 million people on federal welfare. I mean, we've never had that for so long. I can't possibly imagine how you could think that President Obama is a great president when we have so many people on welfare. I mean, if we didn't live in a digital age, the welfare lines and bread lines would be around stores for who knows how long. But the big thing is, that's the biggest thing.
I don't think the CBO is garbage. I think it's respected by people on both sides, and justifiably so. Again, I used some statistics in my opening statement about the economy. One I didn't get to was that Mitt Romney promised in 2012 that if he won and his policies were enacted, if they reduced taxes, if they got big government out of the way, they got these regulations out of the way that were strangling growth, by the end of his term, we'd get below 6% unemployment. That would be the fruit of this free market reform that he promised. Well, we're under 5% now. So by
unemployment
is below 5%. So if you go by Mitt Romney's standards, we've gone beyond the measure of success. So I think if you try to look at the measures that Matt was using, the measures that most people were using, the economy is actually growing at a pretty good clip.
But you're blaming.
I'm going to address your point. I predict is that the labor force participation rate is lower than it's been since 1978, or I forget what the latest is, but it's around there. Some of that is due to aging, and we got the damn boomers. And I'm sorry for insulting all of you who fit that category. They are retiring, they are exiting the workforce, but there's also, I think, reason to believe, looking at the disability numbers, for example, and some other things, that policies have contributed to people not reentering the workforce. And I mean, I think even as the headline unemployment rate looks shinier looks shiny right now as a headline unemployment rate, the fact of that labor force participation rate and that wages have been flat for 15 years, although they've recently started to go up a little bit, people feel like things have kind of sucked for a while now. That's a real feeling. If that feeling wasn't there, we wouldn't have had, my God, an independent socialist come close to winning the Democratic Party nomination. And then who knows what Donald Trump is winning the Republican nomination. There is a real felt sense of economic dissatisfaction. There's a world of difference between 1.2% growth and 3.5% growth. And I think that we've been feeling that. And I would put some of that at the doorstep of Obama-era economic policy.
Can I talk about that a little bit?
Go ahead, please.
Sure. Yes. Professors Reinhardt and Rogoff did a good paper about how financial crises lead to deeper recessions than other kinds of recessions. The kind of normal recession you have is going to be much, much worse if it has a financial crisis, because this has much, much deeper effects. By that standard, the recovery we've had has been unusually strong. I think it's the dozen countries that had a systemic financial crisis in 08, only two had recovered their GDP by 2014, the United States and Germany. And if you look at historical countries that have had the kind of systemic financial crisis that occurred before Obama took office, the growth pattern in the United States ranks near the top in that recovery. That doesn't mean things are always going to be great, but the typical period can be years and years and years until you recover the standard of living that's lost. And it's been sort of bad luck for President Obama that he, unlike Roosevelt, who took office 3 years after the trough of the Depression, Obama took office right when we were plunging off the cliff, and all he could do was to mitigate the damage. And that's not a thing you're going to get a lot of credit for, is when he could say, well, it would have been so much worse without me. But that's the situation he was
in. But it wasn't him who mitigated the damage. It was Hank Paulson who gave us $787 trillion for the TARP.
Excuse me. I'm sorry you asked your question, but I appreciate it. Let's have the next question, please. If you want to comment later, you can. Thank you.
Hi, thanks for your time. So my question is for you. I'm sorry, I don't know your name.
Jonathan Chait.
Oh, thanks. Nice. I'm just going to make 2 points and then ask 2 quick questions, and that's basically it. So I'm a financial advisor. I think in terms of dollars and cents, you know, for the most part. So everyone's familiar with the concept of net worth, right, which is assets minus liabilities. So everyone has a number, and it might be, you know, I don't know, 10,000, 10 million, negative 2,000, whatever. So when you talk about black people and minorities in general, I don't have the numbers to back this up, but I'm of the opinion that average net worth for black people is lower today than it was in 2008, okay? And then if you look at black unemployment and other financial indicators, those numbers have not trended in a positive direction. So that's one point. Second point is with the Ferguson stuff and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Are you talking about riots? You're talking about property damage, you know, people destroying buildings and stuff like that. What that does is that scares away capital. So when you have investors, you know, people say, okay, I want to make some money, so I'm going to open up a Walmart in this neighborhood, blah, blah. When they look on TV and they see these raging fires in places across the country, And these are spontaneous situations that pop up, and you never know when it's going to happen. That's going to drive up your insurance rate. And personally, if I had a couple million dollars to throw around, I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't invest my money into a black neighborhood right now. So, and also, obviously, there's the stuff with the Chicago murder rates. So the point I want to make is what about results? It seems to me that black people are not doing well right now, and Obama has not had a good effect. So the question is do you feel that Obama was a good leader for the quote-unquote black community? What does the Democratic Party offer black people? And why is Donald Trump bad for black people?
Wow, okay.
Well, that's a lot of questions. That's like a half hour worth of responding.
Let me try to address the Obama good part, just an Obama part. Forget Trump.
Unemployment is lower among African Americans now than it was in 2009. The uninsured rate fell disproportionately among African Americans. I think Matt and I agree mostly on the Obama administration's response to Ferguson in policing reform. Where maybe we don't. You're looking at me curiously.
The lights in my eyes.
The Obama administration went into a lot of these communities, met with stakeholders, met with community activists, met with Black Lives Matter activists, met with police. Found common ground and has been working sort of community by community and finding associations to the sort of policing that could be acceptable and legitimate within the community. I think that's mostly positive. He's never endorsed rioting. He's always condemned rioting. He's never endorsed shooting police officers. He's always opposed shooting police officers. In fact, when the Department of Justice went in and did its Ferguson report, they said that the hands up, don't shoot narrative that protesters said was true was not true. They were brutally honest. They said to a lot of their supporters, what do you think happened there? Didn't happen. But what they said, what they found about the predatory practices of the government on the community there and the predatory practices of the police department, I think were well taken points. And because they were fair on both sides, I think their report on all those issues was really accepted. And I think they've actually had some success with some solutions.
I just think that the time for reports, I'm happy that they did reports and that they were pretty good. But you know, there was a lot of discussion of like, we need to have more discussions and focus groups and stuff. Like, no, actually, we know what to do. One thing that you do is stop the federal government working with local governments to take people's stuff, right? Civil asset forfeiture, which was rolled back a little bit under Eric Holder, and then it was kind of re-rolled back. Loretta Lynch, huge fan of asset forfeiture when she was working around these parts of the country. There are things you could do. What do you think a bad cop is going to do when you have a tool saying, well, let's see, where's Jim Epstein? I don't like you, Jim Epstein. You're probably on drugs. Probably true, by the way. So even though I'm not going to even charge you with a freaking crime, I'm going to take your iPhone and your bike and the fancy camera equipment that you have, and then I'm going to share it with my bros back home, and we're going to use that money for our own police department. That is what America has had for a long time. We know it's wrong. We've had the studies and the commission reports and all that kind of crap. We haven't changed that at the federal government level. I'm disappointed that the talks and the reports and things like that haven't led to more kind of like, let's just fix this thing and stop giving bad people tools.
Well, it's controlled at the local level. So you have to be deliberative.
It's a federal program the equitable sharing program is a federal program. That can be ripped up by its roots and shit.
But policing in general is handled at the local
also
level.
True.
So,
next question.
Yeah, you said Obama chose the least terrible path in regards to the wars. Wouldn't the least terrible path be to stop murdering women and children? And when do we end the wars then?
Can you handle that? Go ahead.
I don't think there's an easy answer to that question. I think you have a large group that is at war with America in places where they're getting through. They're killing people at a higher rate.
It's clearly failed, though. So when do we pull out?
Well, again, that's the counterfactual problem. I don't think you can say that if we halted all strikes against al-Qaeda, we'd have success and that they'd go home. I don't think that's a reasonable, realistic counterfactual program.
Any comment?
Yeah, I don't think we should be droning people in countries that we're not at war with.
Thank you.
Next question.
Yeah, after the Obama... after the Orlando massacre... There were a lot of questions about... That was a Freudian slip, I'm honest.
That's totally fine.
there was a lot of commentary about gun rights, and Obama said we have to, you know, clamp down on these gun rights, but there was no mention of the terror. And I was wondering, since now the wife of that terrorist has been indicted, how do you feel about his relationship between guns and terrorism, and whether or not he addresses one of the subjects based on what happened?
We'll have to let that question stand because I, unfortunately, I got my signals crossed. We're out of time. But you might want to address that question in your summation. The positive goes first. We have 5 minutes of summation from Jonathan, followed by 5 minutes of summation from Matt. Think about how you're going to vote as you listen to them summarize. Jonathan, take it away. 5 minutes.
I've lost the thread.
You lost the thread. The resolution is, based on his record of accomplishments, Obama has been a great president. That's the thread.
Right.
Please address
so,
that.
Yeah. The case I try to make in this book is that he had some clear successes in foreign policy. He had some questionable situations where it's hard to figure out if there was a better path, but it can't be called a success. He didn't have any major failures in foreign policy. On domestic policy, he set out to change a lot of areas of government, and he did what he wanted to do. I know people are talking about Trump being able to roll it back, but I think he's already discovering that it's much easier said than done, that he's probably has the votes to roll back the upper income tax increases that Obama passed, because that's something Republicans care a lot about, and that doesn't hurt anybody directly. Taking away insurance from 20 million people without having a plan to replace it, which they don't, is going to produce enormous pain, not only to the people who would have gotten that care, but to doctors, hospitals, and insurers who are screaming their heads off. So I think something like what he did on healthcare is going to stand. I think the reforms he put in place on climate have their own momentum that is going to continue, that solar energy and wind energy have been stood up, and they're going to continue to expand, that electric cars are going to continue to expand. Other countries don't want to go back to unlimited carbon emissions, and they responded to the election of Trump by saying, we're not going to tear up this agreement. We're going to find a way to work around it. Dodd-Frank reshaped the finance industry, took away the too-big-to-fail benefit, increased the amount of assets that firms have to hold, reduced the amount of risk, reduced the amount of fraud. You need 60 votes to take that down, and they don't have them in the Senate. Education reform is working its way through schools across most states, and it's working. And these charter schools that have blossomed, some of them are having extraordinary results, and those students are going to want those schools taken away, and I don't think anybody's going to go do that either. And no one's going to go back and bring back the 2008 financial crisis, because by definition, you can't go back in time and change that. So I think most of what Obama did, contrary to what people are saying, is actually going to stand the test of time, and it's going to be difficult or impossible for Trump to roll it back.
Okay, thank you. And Matt, you have 5 minutes to make your summation.
So you should know, in case you don't, that I'm the type of person who about a year ago at this time, I was busy frantically trying to collaborate with Lucy Steigerwald and Ken Lane, just to throw two bizarre people names out there, on a book that would be titled, yes, that's obviously for Steigerwald, a book titled Every President is Terrible. So yes, I'm kind of coming from a slightly kind of negative point of view when it comes to assessing presidents, but I've been trying to be fair in this presentation. I'm going to hold up a president who I also found in my own way, especially since I was a teenager in California near where the Western White House was at the time, Ronald Reagan, as someone, as a way of demonstrating that Jonathan's attempt at the premise here, and again, I'm reminding people who are voting there, it's that Obama presidency, great, same sentence. Even though I wouldn't necessarily describe Ronald Reagan as great, it's not hard. You don't have to screw up your face. You don't have to prove a negative. If you try to think of what are some of the things that jump out at you with, say, Ronald Reagan, who, by the way, is someone who Obama was very, very conscious about trying to emulate. He wanted to have the same impact on American politics and the sort of ship of state as Ronald Reagan did. He read up on him a lot. So Ronald Reagan, he helped croak inflation. He helped croak the Soviet Union, and the economy ran pretty well for the last 6 years there, five, 6 years of it. It's not hard to make the case. You see it. It's there. You can dispute parts of it, and God knows we would, and I would, and I'd probably agree with a lot of it. But, like, those are the big ones. They're flashing red lights over here in the corner. With Obama, it's, well, we didn't prevent the Great Depression. You know, Obamacare, which today, literally is the first day since its passage, as far as I know, in which 50% of Americans have said that, okay, maybe I like this thing. It's only when faced with the way that the repeal and replace hamburger is being made on Capitol Hill, and faced with changing their healthcare status, which is a very traumatic people, as a lot of people learned during the implementation of Obamacare, found out themselves. But it's never it's never been popular. It's not a widely hailed law. I mean, Bill Clinton was running against this back in the fall, or at least aspects of it, and saying it doesn't make any sense, and these types of things. So we're proving negatives. And on climate, again, we're talking about the biggest impact, measurable one that we can see right now, is not getting in the way of fracking. Whether the Paris Agreement turns out to be a great thing and a lasting thing, these are things that we're going to see in the future. The EPA regulations, whether they survive on Copeland, we're going to find that out. These are in the future. So we might find out. But we also might find out that a lot of things that don't seem like a problem now are going to look problematic in the future, because bad things eventually happen. Dodd-Frank, is that an unalloyed great bill? I'm not so sure. It's the reason why you can't use your debit card to buy a 40-ouncer anymore, right? Because of these micromanagement of interbank fees and these types of things. It didn't touch Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. There wasn't kind of a root and branch look at one of the bigger centers of the financial industry collapse. It wasn't there. We don't know if these banks are now too big to fail or not, because we're not going to see it until the next financial crisis. And if you think that there's not going to be a next financial crisis, I would point to you to the signing ceremony of Sarbanes-Oxley, when George W. Bush said, this is the most sweeping reforms that we've had since the New Deal and the Great Depression, and there will be no more Enrons. That's it. We're done. We're all in this shiny new future. So I fear that we're going to look not just at foreign policy, which I don't think has been a success at all, and I would characterize, unlike Jonathan, Libya as a very important failure, as well as giving Donald Trump a loaded gun in a lot of different ways. I think we're going to look 5 years from now when the next bad thing happens, and we're going to see, what did this guy do for us to help prepare that bad thing? And we're going to think of that behavior worse than we currently do now, even as we remember the guy that we kind of liked as a dude.
Thank you, Matt. Okay, that closes the debate. Please, Eitan. You're going to come forward. Please look at your cell phones. Vote on the resolution for, against, or undecided. How do we stand? Is the debate is it coming through?
Yeah, it looks like people are done.
Okay, so can you show me the before and after? Close the voting, and you can show me the results. Okay. All right. Oops. Thank you. Okay, the vote results. Oh, wow. Okay. It looks as though the Matt Welch's won the debate. Jonathan Chait lost some ground. He lost 9 percentage points. He started with 31, and he went down to 22. Matt went from 50 to 74, 75, so he picked up votes. It looks as though Matt wins the Tootsie Roll. Congratulations, Matt. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Jonathan Chait will be signing books. Jonathan Chait will be signing books. We'll be over there to talk with you. Jonathan, you can stand. Go ahead, Jonathan.
I'm sorry that 50% of you were ready to think Obama was a great president before this room. I wasn't quite getting that vibe, but I clearly have let down the people on my side.
Okay, 1/3 to 22. Okay, well, we'll post that later. All right, but Jonathan will be selling books over there, signing books. So if you want to talk to Jonathan, you should walk over there. We have wine. We have food. We've got Matt Welch sticking around as well if you want to beat up on him.
Yes.
So let's do that. Thank you very much.